So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. New episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, David, this is so good. We're hitting a rhythm here week after week
after week,
and you're just lining up these great guests.
Well, I look
forward to every conversation.
It's, like I said, it's so fun to get to invite people, first of all. And now, like I mentioned the other day, we are getting people who want to come and join us, and they're sending an email here and there asking if they could crash the party.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, we are recording this on a beautiful autumn day here in Middle Tennessee.
Yes.
Clear blue sky and the
crisp.
Sun is shining. And I'm going to go for a walk this afternoon with Ian Cron out in Percy Warner. I understand that's a great place to take a walk. I've never done that before.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is a great place. And, you know, walking with Ian, that'll be a great day. You'll have a great time.
That's
going to be fun.
And I imagine you're going for your customary 15-mile run?
Huh? Yes, my post-podcast 15-mile run. Yeah.
Oh, it just feels so pathetic. I went in this week for a routine stress test just to check the old ticker.
Oh, okay.
Because I did have a what they call a cardiac event a few years ago.
Yeah.
So now I'm under the watchful eye of, you know, the medical community.
Right.
Yeah, it's, you know, and they put you on a treadmill, they wire you up, and they put you
on this
treadmill, and then they, you know, they crank it up, and they start, you're doing okay? Okay, well, we'll make it worse. So you're doing okay? You know, we'll make it worse.
The key is to quit saying yes.
Yes.
You know, you learn to start saying, no, I'm about to die.
You know,
stop it.
And I felt like pretty young and, you know, fit and studly for, you know, in the beginning, but that delusion dissipated over the course of about 9 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
reminded me, I've got to kick up the exercise, David.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've allowed myself to get out of shape.
Yeah. Well, it is easy to do, and you know, it's easy to let time pass, and what feels like I haven't worked out in a couple of weeks actually in reality might be 8 months. I'll tell you, here's my secret, Nate,
okay,
if you
want
to know how I stay so fit and thin
okay,
and trim
okay.
and healthy. I've given up this dessert thing. You know, I've talked about that a little bit. I'm still on the no dessert, no candy, no ice cream, no anything. I had a sugar-free popsicle from the popsicle place in 12 South.
Okay, yeah.
And, you know, it was an all-fruit thing. I had one of those this weekend as my dessert treat. But I've given up on all that stuff, and it's really helping me. But I was still having really a hard time making the gym regular. Now, my building has a gym.
Yeah.
And it's literally...
it's like across the hall.
It is literally out my door, across the commons area, into this little, you know, private little keyed area.
Right.
And it has a beautiful gym. But that was not working for me for whatever reason. I needed a different gym.
It was too convenient.
Well, it was too convenient, and it was smaller. And, you know, you could turn the
TV. Was it kind of like a hotel gym?
It's bigger than a hotel gym, and they've got adequate equipment. But I just couldn't quite make myself get in there.
Mm-hmm.
So across the street is an Anytime Fitness. 24 hours a day, you can go in there anytime. You get a little key fob. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great. So I decided like with all things addiction, my problem was geography.
That's right, exactly.
So I'm going to join another gym across the street and pay money.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah, okay,
you know,
that's
my
good.
Other my gym in my building's free. But you know, I'm gonna go pay money and walk across the street because that will motivate me.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So anyway, I'm still working on getting there with regularity. I'll end it with that. But it is important and it is a part of self-care.
Yeah,
and it is a thing, but yeah, sometimes it's not the geography wasn't quite the problem I thought it was.
And I will tell you this, that what happens to me is that when I'm engaged in something that feels missional and big and mm-hmm. important,
yeah,
like what I'm doing now with Samson Society, and it yeah. seems like, and I see how great the need is and how great the opportunity is. I can get all swept up in that campaign and forget to freaking eat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Much less go to the gym.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-care is crucially important. I think we should have a conversation today that kind of centers on that. How do we take care of, pursue a mission, pursue a calling, and care for others without losing sight of ourselves?
Exactly. And we've got a guest coming up who knows exactly how that feels and how to do it.
Well, stay with us, listeners. We'll be back in a minute here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And David, you have some fascinating friends.
I do.
I mean, you hang out with the coolest people in this therapeutic world of yours.
Well, therapists are cool people. I mean, because everybody, you know, has kind of done their thing, and then they end up in therapy, and then they end up becoming therapists. And so,
is that how it happens?
That's how it goes.
Yeah. Okay.
So you have to actually do it. So, yeah, I do. I have a great friend today that I'm real excited to have on with
Introduce
us.
Her.
Well, we have Karen Moran. And Karen is what we call a LADAC, which is a licensed alcohol and drug abuse counselor.
Oh, okay. I could probably come up with some other.
You're looking at me like, excuse me? You know, that's not stacking pallets at, you know, a loading dock.
That's
it's
not
actually
where
a person
going at
that.
All. Okay,
no,
go
I know. That, I know. Right. I know you well enough. I'm trying to save you, Nate. Let me. We're off to a great start.
Okay, go ahead.
You can tell we've been cutting up before we ever started hitting record. But Karen is, first of all, in practice here in the greater Nashville area.
Mm-hmm.
And she and I got to know one another through a variety of recovery circles, but also through our common church, St. Augustine's Episcopal Church.
On Vanderbilt
campus downtown. And And Karen and I just have had a couple of coffees and talked about work and life and how we got here. And she's been a great resource to me about helping me understand some of the uniquenesses, I guess, Karen, of what we do. And I'm not a LADAC. She's got a lot more street cred. So I'm thrilled. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here.
Us. Yeah. So Karen, how did you... first of all, tell us a little bit about your background, then we'll get into how you got started in the work you do.
Sure. So my professional background
mm-hmm.
is that I started in the late 90s, sort of directionless, and decided to try working in this field, and began working with teenagers. So the first 15 years of my career was exclusively working with teenagers, adolescents, and their families.
Oh, wow.
And from there, I've worked in different environments. Early on in my career, it was acute psychiatric facilities, and treatment centers, largely. Mm-hmm. And I always had a passion for working with addicts and alcoholics. Well, I should say, when I stopped dating them, I developed a passion for having a boundary that was less painful. So, and it has turned out to be a lot more fruitful. How's that for a start?
And it probably pays better, right? So it's
like... It most definitely.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you this, Karen. Let's rewind it all the way back to when you were just a tow-headed, beautiful little girl. Did you grow up in the fabled, fully functional family, or was yours a little bit sideways?
Wow, what does that look like? Is that a thing? That's like a unicorn.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So I grew up, as you might have be able to speculate, in a family where there was addiction.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And many faces of addiction.
Sure. Mm.
And so when people ask how long I have been in the substance use disorder field, I'm like, well, starting with in utero.
Yeah.
My education began there.
Yeah.
And from there, it's, you know, become more varied and expansive. So, yes, I grew up in a family where there was intergenerational addiction.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And if I can be personal, where did you gravitate then in your own coping behavior around addiction?
So it's so funny. My daughter, I have a 14-year-old daughter who has become addicted to The Masked Singer. I don't know if you're familiar with this show. I am only so familiar because she talks about it incessantly.
Mm-hmm.
But Donny Osmond was one of the guest performers in one of the costumes, and she has now found a connection point for me because my early pre-sexual era in time was obsessed with teen idols.
Okay.
I mean, my walls were plastered. There was this, and I always say my first drug of choice was fantasy.
I gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so I built castles in the sky, and my mom laughs today because I think I was maybe 10, and I was begging my mom to take us to Provo, Utah on summer vacation so that I could meet Donnie and we could wed.
Yeah, sure, yeah, right.
I knew nothing about Mormonism or anything, but I would have been willing to change. I mean, I would have done whatever.
Yeah.
And that was a pattern that emerged as I began dating. And so my my first drug of choice was fantasy, and then relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went to treatment in 1989, there was no SLA movement.
Right.
It was codependency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we
SLA
were,
for our uninitiated listeners would be Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So that came later. That came after I was already in recovery and under the umbrella of codependency for sure. So when I went to treatment, it was to address sex and love addiction, which was my drug of choice primarily, and just really. You know, when I would look at sort of the spectrum of my life, from the time I was in sixth grade, I was never not without a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I always had a couple on the back burner, you know, because you need some extras. Yeah. Sometimes, especially the ones I chose, weren't always reliable.
You needed
to have a couple of people in the wings ready for. And so when I went to treatment, I had a full... disintegration, failed suicide attempt.
Wow.
I had found what I thought was the holy grail of boyfriends, a recovering addict 2 years clean in NA.
Mm-hmm.
So he had all the right chaotic features I needed. And yet he had this really remarkable spirituality that I'd never seen, and certainly not in anyone who'd ever been attracted to me. So, so he was the answer. Like, this was the guy.
Right.
And when he said to me, I have to leave this relationship or I'm going to use again.
Oh, wow.
I was like, well, I mean, it would be helpful if you did. Then I would, you know, have a role. But I didn't have enough insight to say that. But in hindsight, that's the sort of fantasy conversation I would have had if I'd been able to be honest.
Yeah.
But it was true. My obsessiveness and my need for... somebody validating that I was not going to drown in my own self.
Mm.
And I needed somebody to be that life raft.
Yeah.
And he was it. He was the one. I mean, ordained by God, it was to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when he left, I had made no friends in 3 years of college. Mm-hmm. Everything in my world centered around this relationship.
Sure.
Wow.
And it was, I didn't want to live. Like, it was so painful. I still can... you know, I celebrated 30 years this last summer in recovery, which was amazing. Wow. And I can still remember how it ached in my fingernails and toenails every waking moment.
Yeah.
When he left.
Yeah.
That just, there was nothing here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, when I work with clients today, I talk about the problem isn't that other people abandon us. The problem is that when they leave, they take us with them.
Oh wow.
And then there's no one here.
Yeah.
And that's a devastating experience.
Sure.
So my healing through my original program was through CODA and Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, ACA work, which was to come later. They kept wanting to talk in treatment about my folks. And I'm like, no, we have to talk about my boyfriend. Like, they're fine.
Yes,
nothing
right.
to see there.
Right, yeah.
This is the problem.
Right.
It took me some time and convincing to see that it went much, much deeper than any one dude.
And ACA work for the uninitiated would be adult children of alcoholics.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's as though that boyfriend who came along during your late adolescence, early adulthood, he matched some sort of a template or a pattern that had been set very, very early.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just emotionally unavailable enough to be familiar.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'm aware of, and this is fast-forwarding quite a bit from that era for me, because I have been in... I wouldn't say perpetual therapy, but I have secured and maintained therapy since I went to treatment.
Sure.
And maintained recovery program that has served me well. And but one of the things I know today and looking back is that it's the mind's job to be right.
Mm. Ooh.
And
there's a line.
Yeah.
Okay.
My mind was made up that I didn't have value, and I learned that. Not because anybody that I was related to had an intention of that. As a matter of fact, if you were to ask, well, one of my parents is deceased, but if you were to ask either of my parents, they'd be like, well, we adored you. You know, we loved
you. Yes, right.
But intergenerational trauma is such that we pass along our blind spots to our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the best of intentions, my folks did the same.
Yes.
And as a result of that, their blind spot was that I did not feel seen. I did not feel valued, particularly by my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that manifested in my relationships. I went looking for it. And when we don't have those core needs met as children, we become seekers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we begin to reach outside of ourselves to find that missing piece. And so I began seeking in this template of male attention,
mm-hmm.
where I was looking to have it be fixed. And the fantasy included my dad too. If only he would this, if only he would that, if he would see me, if I could be. And mm-hmm. I did all kinds, dressed up and did all kinds of things to try and be seen and ineffectively, because I wrongly assessed as a kid through my egocentric lens that it was about me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, but my mind was made up that it was. And so as an adult or as a young adult, adolescent, I believed I didn't have worth and value. And when I say it's the mind's job to be right, what that means is that I believed it. I certainly didn't treat myself as a being of worth and value. But I also unconsciously drew to myself people who would reinforce that belief.
Sure.
Had I dated somebody who thought I hung the moon and who I dazzled, quite frankly, they'd have scared the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah.
And
right.
I would have thought there was some. It's that old Groucho Marx. I wouldn't belong to any club that would have someone like me as a member.
Right.
Yeah.
So if they did, well, there would be something wrong with them. Like something really wrong. And so it wasn't even. I remember somebody in treatment saying, I said at some point, are there healthy guys out there? Are there healthy males in the world?
Yeah, yeah.
And my therapist said, sure there are, but don't worry about them. You're not going to meet them. She wasn't wrong, although it was mean.
Yeah.
She's like, you're not going to have anything in common with them. Don't worry about them. They're just going to move on by, and so are you.
Yeah.
Well, Karen, when did you know personally that you were in trouble? Was it just the one particular boyfriend that cut things off who seemed so right? Or did you have an idea that there might be a pattern going on here that you were just continually blind spotting? Or,
you know, I certainly had pain. It's an interesting question, actually. Nobody's ever asked me that. I think that relationship is the one that is so glaring mm-hmm. because he was the healthiest of the litter, for sure. Yeah. And nobody'd ever, like, I was the one to end relationships because I moved on to greener pastures. And that was mm-hmm. part of how I took power back.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any, and so the power I had was my ability to lure and attract, and I wasn't so interested in keeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I right. just needed right. to get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And so that was where my power lived. And so I hopped before anybody could get too close, see too much the stuff that I believed was there that was unworthy. And
mm-hmm.
And so he was the first person that I was attached enough to stay and that boundaried up with me.
Yeah.
So I would say that there might have been clues along the way, but I was really thorough in my medicators and how I just had layers. I was resourceful and resilient, and I knew how to not hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So when I would bump into that pain, you know, my codependency has lots of tentacles. So the male dependency piece was certainly how it manifested then. Now, as a 51-year-old woman, it is very different, and I'm mindful differently. It doesn't manifest that way at all. I don't have the energy for any of that anymore. And it's not as fun as it used to be. And now I got a sort of that head full of AA, belly full of beer thing. I know too much, uh-huh. you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
not even appealing anymore.
Yeah.
Now it's more about, and I think I shared this in church when you were presenting in the last Adult Sunday School. Mm-hmm. Now my nature, and I don't say this to be arrogant, my nature is to give. Like, I have a servant's heart, and I know that.
Mm-hmm.
And in my codependency is not all toxic and pathological. And mm-hmm. at the root of it,
how beautiful
is this really, I think it's my humanity. And it's why I do what I do for a living. It's I have an interest in people, and people I love deeply, and I am incredibly I have a desire to do for and be present for.
Mm-hmm.
And my inclination that still, after 30 years of one day at a time, I still have to be really mindful to not let myself move to the back of the line in terms of self-care.
Yeah.
And there are seasons where that's harder than others. You know, what I was talking about this weekend at church is my dog ingested a cassette tape this weekend.
Okay.
And yeah. almost, it's a puppy.
And for our uninitiated listeners, a cassette tape.
I didn't even know I still had a cassette tape.
Yeah, yeah.
And P.S., the surgical team had a question about it when they were making bets on which cassette tape it was.
Uh-huh.
And it was a guided meditation for healing.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Well,
the irony.
But his intentions were good.
His intentions were good. And so that, you know, the weekend turned out differently than I'd expected. I was supposed to do some work, and my daughter had some needs, and I had a lot of things going on. And it wasn't until, you know, Saturday night when the dog's in the hospital and I just purchased the most expensive cassette tape known to man, and all the yeah. things are happening, where I was just like, what the absolute fuck? I just crashed, and I'm like, I'm so tired and so overwhelmed, and almost didn't go to church because I just was like, I just want to climb into my bed and
yeah.
not yeah. exist for a minute. And those are the moments where I am like, okay, I did it again. I didn't take care of myself. I haven't, you know, done my foundational needs of the pyramid. I haven't mm-hmm. taken care of my nutrition and my exercise and my rest and my
mm-hmm.
all the things, and letting fear get the better of me. And so I got up and went to church. Like, that's
damn
a strong
it.
Start. That's a strong start.
Yeah.
And I have to still be really deliberate to not deprioritize myself.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of people around me that I love and are in varying degrees of need, and I want to be the one who can be of service.
Right.
Yeah.
And the good news today is that I know sometimes slightly after the fact, but I know when that road runs out. Mm-hmm. And I know in my body where that feeling lives.
Yeah.
And it is unmistakable today. So I don't have to flounder around in the of that for weeks and months and years.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I think maybe we both arrive at the edge of the same cliff from different angles. I mean, you come there with a servant's heart. I tend to come with a Messiah complex. But
I can do that too. I can do that too.
Yeah, but I still want to save everybody.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, the applause is also quite important.
Applause is nice.
Yeah.
I like cookies.
I'd love for you to unpack a little bit more. So we often say in recovery that here we learn a new way of life. And you've been talking about the foundational elements of self-care, what are so easy to neglect when we're in that unhealthy place. What was it like for you? What lessons did you learn early, and in what order? How did you have to start rearranging your day and your life in a way that was healthier?
Wow. In the beginning, when I think about that question, I go right back to sort of the origins. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, I will say that I am not as rigorous and rigid as I was in the beginning of this journey, because I had very much the gift of desperation, which meant that I was willing to do anything necessary to not feel as horrible as it felt before.
Right.
And so I took every suggestion and went after it with, starting my day with structure, with prayer and meditation, and reading out of my ACA meditation book, and 90 meetings in 90 days. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because my aftercare was here in Nashville. I grew up in South Florida. And so I went to treatment in Chattanooga at a place that is no longer there called the Crossroads, and it was magnificent. And it was the Arizona model, which meant it was experiential treatment, where we were beating on batakas and doing all kinds of, it was profoundly moving for me.
Wow.
I feel like I exited after 30 days practically hovering above the ground. Like, it was just this incredible spiritual, things were like the ahas were going off all over the place, and I just was seeing life through an entirely different lens. And so I was as willing as I've ever been to do anything new, because these people knew what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
they were helping me know myself in ways I'd never stopped to think about. And so so I did a lot of things, everything that was suggested, and my aftercare contract, which amuses me today, was so specific. They knew me so well. I was not to be alone with a non-blood relative male for the first year.
Wow.
I was not to be alone with a non-blood relative male for the first year. And it actually said that, not to be alone, period.
Yeah, yeah.
Because everybody becomes an option when I'm desperate enough.
Yeah.
My bar just lowers and lowers with loneliness, right? Like, well, that one has a pulse,
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
He looks like he might use deodorant from time to time. So that's a win. And so that was the structure that I began with. And I had assignments by my primary therapist and my aftercare therapist and my sponsor to, my job was to, I heard a client say this recently, to court myself.
Mm. Ooh.
So I needed to, and I was living alone for the first time. I was 21. And so I was out of college and I'd never adulted. So I was learning how to adult too.
Yeah.
And so I had my own apartment and it was like the Taj Mahal to me, even though it was probably a dive, but, that's not how I remember it. and I bought myself flowers every week, and I went to dinner alone. And this was before cell phones. Uh-huh. So I like to actually go sit alone and make eye contact with people.
Yeah, nothing to look at.
Nothing to look at, nothing to distract with. And I wasn't allowed to bring a book, if I recall correctly, that I needed to be present with me and to allow the discomfort of being alone be visible, be known to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I was doing was proving to myself that it wasn't going to kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a new phenomenon for me, because it very much felt like it would not that I allowed it to get too close, but as a matter of fact, within a year of the time that I'm talking about now, I was at an NA meeting and somebody shared while they were telling their story that this sentence I will never forget. And the young man who was talking, who I don't know, don't remember, said, "I have never known anybody who's died from an emotion, and I've known too many people who've died trying not to have one."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that resonated under my skin. And at this time, I was going to every 12-step program that existed, which weren't many.
Yeah.
But at the time in Nashville, because Oprah had just gotten a hold of the word codependent, right? And all the books were out. It was the same couple of years that The Dance of Anger and Codependent No More came out and all those original stuff. And so there were as many CODA meetings here in Nashville as there were AA.
Oh, wow.
Really? Wow.
And so I was able to go multiple times a day to CODA meetings, and it was amazing. I remember going to one over on 21st Avenue in a building that isn't even there anymore. Every time I drive by it, I think, God, that was my home group, you know, whatever that building is right now. And so a lot of I was leaning in terms of my investment in the program and doing everything that was suggested. And today, flash forward 30 years, it doesn't have the same sort of rigidity to it. And there's a lot of, you know, it's so interesting working in the substance use disorder field because there's a lot of beliefs even within the recovery community about how many meetings are necessary. And everybody's sort of at a point.
Right.
It's like, do I still need to be, you know, holding on with both hands to this thing? And many people say yes, you know, and that's valid and fair. And then there are people who say, you know, my point in getting in recovery was to be able to be in the world. And so I want to have this, and I want to not lose the foundations of this, but I also want to be able to have the freedom to be present in my life and in other kinds of relationships. And I would say that that's where I fall. You know, I continue to have a therapist, and with every era, you know, I a few years ago, I was getting ready to turn 50. I left a 20-year marriage, and I had cancer.
Wow.
And I survived cancer. And so I had in that moment three things happening at once that required that I lean back into my program and lean back into my own work and be willing to take a look at what this new era brings. And that I'm glad that I have no reluctance to do that today. Like, that is a tried and true template, and I don't have even a moment's pause when it's time. I live in consultation today. I surround myself with people who speak truth to me and who aren't afraid of pissing me off for the most part. And not that I, you know, I'm too codependent to get super pissed. I get over it very fast because I can't take it. But and I have a lot of humor in my life, which is necessary because I happen to operate both, which can be a shadow side, and I'm an Enneagram 7, which is the enthusiast. And so, which I'm only beginning to understand. I don't know all of that necessarily, but I use humor a lot. And so I always say I can use it for good or evil. You know, I can use it to deny real experiences, but I also have the belief that it can be funny. If it can be funny later, it can be funny now.
Oh,
there you
That's good. Yeah.
And trying to find, and that carried me through cancer. I'm here to tell you, I had lots of humor during that.
I was going to say, I mean, a terrible illness and divorce and all that you were carrying at that season. I mean, if your brain didn't have humor, I mean, good Lord.
I mean, nobody wants to go down those dark passages again. And so, and the humor comes, honestly, the humor also, as much as I can use it to run, for sure, it also comes from, I believe, for me, as a fundamental spiritual belief, that it really is going to be okay.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how, usually. I just believe that it will because it always has. You know, when I get scared about money, weird things show up in the mail. And God is you know, I call my higher power God, and God is just big enough and knows me past my bullshit. And I don't feel alone today because what I used to seek in relationships or seek in being indispensable to people so they won't leave me or all the things that I did, I've heard it described as a God-shaped hole and nothing fits in it like God. And I tried to hammer square pegs in round holes all over my life and nothing fits in it like God. And I'm not perfect at that and I still freak out and I still have my process, but letting God show up through other people, letting, you know, people who speak truth to me, people who bring humor when I need it. One of my dearest friends, shout out to Jody Green, who is a licensed clinical social worker and also has a journey of healing that is profound. I won't out her on podcast, but she will out herself at some point. And she is, we are just so alike. And all I have to do is call her and she says exactly what I need to hear.
Yeah.
Has me name my shame gremlin, as Brené Brown says. And laughs with me and you know, she's always sort of famous for saying, I need you to stop talking right now about me. Because I'm sharing about myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, you need to shut up because now I'm uncomfortable and quit talking about me.
Yeah.
You know. Well, so Karen, why moving, you know, kind of fast forward into your professional life, why the LADAC licensure and not just sticking with, you know, something more general, you know, hang your shingle out, come one, come all?
Well, I tell you, in my, as I said before, my early experiences were just sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I worked in acute psychiatric facilities in the beginning and had exposure to working with individuals with lots of different things going on. First of all, the license is a specialty license for substance use disorders, and that includes the family system.
Right.
I know nothing like I know that.
Yeah.
And so when, as soon as I began sort of, it has been referred to as a professional codependent, what I do. but when I began working professionally with addicts and alcoholics and family members, I just knew it. I knew it at a cellular level. And it's so funny, in the beginning in the field, it was very divisive. The people that I worked with exclusively were people who had substance use disorders. I was among the very few who represented the family faction of that system because people who are drawn to work with addicts tend to be addicts. And I, by the way, I consider myself an addict. In the beginning, it was recovering codependent, but I got to tell you, in 30 years of sitting across from people with lots of different addictions, there is no them. There is only us. You know, there is not a single thing I've heard uttered, even though I haven't used every drug or engaged in every behavioral addiction. Man, I get it.
Yeah.
I don't have to have, you know, gone carpet surfing for beats of cocaine to know what the desperation of that moment feels like. I have had my own version of that. And so it's, I just know it. I know it at my own level. But more than that, what it grew into, it started off with just my way. This is how I healed. This is the suggestions that were given to me. So I began sort of just parroting back what was told to me, sort of like being a paid sponsor of sorts. And it evolved into understanding and really being blown away by all the ways that people heal, all the paths. And all the passages. Mine was one way, and I loved my way. It worked for me. It was right on cue and exactly what I needed. And since then, I have met people who have just astounding journeys that look different than mine, but their wake ups and their aha moments. And, you know, I am a junkie for that. I love being in the presence of somebody who is waking up to, for the first time, to something that you just know in your belly is going to be revolutionary. Like they are currently staging a coup right in front of me in between their ears about what is about to happen in their life. And I freaking love that. I get so excited. And that's where I want to be. I don't, I appreciate work in other areas around, you know, mental health issues. And I'm obviously, I love humans, and so I appreciate the struggles that exist in all those ways. But honestly, when I thought about something broader, it overwhelmed me a little. Like it's almost like there's too much, and how do you ever get effective and competent and skilled at so much? And there are people who do. I'm not knocking them, but I felt like for me, this wheelhouse, I just wanted to be as good as I could be at working with individuals in this wheelhouse. And in some ways it was, I am aware that it was about being of service to my dad in ways I wasn't able to in his life.
Wow.
And that heals parts of me that, you know, that sort of take the misguided original mechanism into something that is more right-sized. And I realize I can't fix anybody. I don't have any power. And 30 years of working in the field and 51 years of being in a family system, I still am no closer to knowing how to help somebody get clean and sober who doesn't want to. That's just the way it is. And my program has had to get stronger because I'm in the presence of this disease all the time. And I have to know how to go home after that. I have to know how to trust God enough to be there for more than just me. And that I don't have any special powers. What I have is I know a little something by a little something when it comes to addiction and recovery, and I have the ability to be objective about other people's lives. That's what I have.
How do you, Karen, and this is, you know, kind of a broader question, but how do you keep from allowing yourself to absorb every story that comes through your office in a day's time that is tragic and sad and probably got some trauma, and you know the shit people do to one another is unbelievable, and every day you're a little bit surprised, and I mean, and how do you keep that from showing up in the car with you when you pick up your daughter, or when you know what I mean?
That's a great question, and I would say I have two thoughts about that. One is the skill set that I've learned over the course of years, because in the beginning, I surely was not as honed at it as I am this many years in. I was young, I was early in recovery, and gratefully then, I had a lot of people holding me accountable. You know, like, I have a sponsor who'd be like, oh, you know, this client was in, and she's like, you gotta drop that shit, it's time for your meeting. God is big enough for all of you, that is not yours, moving on, you know, and you don't have it to give, quite frankly, so your well is still a little dusty. So learning how to, you know, in the beginning, I had a lot of people being very, very direct with me that really helped, because I did not have a good muscle for that early on. And I was also young. I was 21 when I started working in the field, and I was working with adolescents. So some of the, I mean, I felt like a teenager at that time. I didn't feel like an adult. And so there was a lot of ability to relate with that group at that time for me. And so I had also had the benefit of coming out of treatment and having my own resurrection experience and knowing that people can. So it was helping me stay right-sized. Today, there's sort of a born of necessity moment in that. Like, I don't think that I would get to do this as long as I did if I didn't practice compartmentalizing my day differently. And I would say that one of my survival skills from my family of origin is I am a great compartmentalizer. I can put anything in a box. I could leave it there for years. That's not true. It ends up popping out. But for a long time, I can put it in a box. And part of what I do today that's healthier is I know to not leave it there. You know, there's a time and a place to take that down and look at it. And that time and a place is during the confines of my workday, so that those, and there are some easier than others. I'm making this sound like I do this really well all the time, and I got to tell you, there are some stories that are just sort of like watching the movie we were talking about. There are some things that just hang with us, and you know, because we're human and we have compassion for other humans, and we think, God, the atrocities in the world, and but I have to go home and be a mom. And apparently watch a puppy so that he doesn't eat another cassette. And so I have to be able to be present in that world. And if I'm not, and that part begins to unravel, then it starts to cut into my ability to show up for the people who have hired me mm-hmm. to be able to show up for them because yeah. I won't have enough for me.
Right.
And when I run on empty, eventually nobody gets anything,
right.
especially me, but and anybody. And so sometimes I take mental health days from work where yeah. I just wake up and I'm like, nope, can't hold space with other people, too much going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to know myself. And yeah. I also think that models healthy boundaries to the people I work with too,
yeah.
who may not dig that I suddenly had to not be at work today,
mm-hmm.
but I have to be willing to practice what I preach.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so saying to people, sometimes we just don't have it to give to other people
yeah.
and it's unfortunate. God knows I want to do it all the time.
Yeah.
But I can't, and I know I can't, and I have to know where my limits are.
Well, two last questions I have for you.
Mm-hmm.
One is the puppy okay?
The puppy is okay. He's going to be in the cone of shame for 2 weeks, and he's not digging
fun.
That. But
yeah.
but he's on pain medicine, so that's
okay.
making his journey happy.
Okay. And you went to the loan department at the emergency vet because I've been there too. My dog.
I found care credit.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Mine ate a part of a CPAP machine, so it was really nice. But okay, so second question: how do people get a hold of you, and do you have your website going?
I do.
Good for you.
I'm
we talked about
so
that.
So excited! I've been procrastinating
for
that for a long time.
That's awesome.
So that was a proud personal moment to finally push through. So my website is KarenMoranCounseling.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Moran, M-O-R-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other question?
How people can reach you.
So the website is away, and you can click on all the buttons and mm-hmm. email or call me.
Mm-hmm.
My phone number is 615-308-9385.
Great.
My office is in downtown Nashville,
mm-hmm.
Right next to Nashville Children's Theater.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
So I hope that our listeners will take advantage of those in the greater Nashville area
yeah.
That need not just individual work, but family work and systems work with all that goes with all the various aspects of addiction can give Karen
Absolutely.
A shout through that site.
Well, Karen, it has been an absolute delight to have you with us today.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much. This was fun. I was nervous, but this was fun.
Fantastic. And in fact, I'm going to be showing up in that Sunday school class this Sunday.
I heard.
You're here. I just got to find you a parking spot. That's my only assignment.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right. You have to want to be there.
Yeah. I really feel like I made a new friend this morning. So great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
we'll be
you.
Right back. Stay with us on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, Karen challenged me in some ways. That conversation was a wake-up call and I'll use my Baptist word, rededication to some self-care and to some, you are not called to be God.
Yeah,
in the lives of the people you work with and walk
yeah,
with.
Yeah, I'm somewhat disappointed about that. oh, but isn't it so true? There was a word that she used there that I first saw in the Big Book years ago, and she employed it at least twice during your conversation that I have found so useful. She used that term right-sized.
Yeah.
Getting right-sized.
Yeah.
Let's admit today that we are human. Okay,
yeah.
A spiritual being having a human experience, and I've got to honor this body that I'm traveling around in here
yeah.
and take care of things.
Yeah, I was taken with her a couple of references to her referring to where she stores her, angst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she actually can name in her body where that feels like it shows up.
Yeah,
you know, and she knows when that experience happens that she is due for a break.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, I do hope that those within easy traveling distance of Nashville looking for help for a family member, for themselves, for the family system,
yeah,
around addiction. I hope this has been very helpful, and I'm sure it's been very helpful, and I hope they'll reach out to Karen.
Absolutely. You will not regret that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's about it, I guess, for this week's episode of the podcast. We'd love to hear from you, by the way. Thank you for the letters. We do, even the ones that don't get read on the air, get a prompt reply, or at least a reply.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite prompt. You can always reach us at the, at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com.
And we love hearing from you.
Yeah.
We do love hearing from you.
All right. Well, until next week, then, on behalf of the magnificent Rex,
the man
guy
behind
who
the curtain,
really makes all the magic happen.
Absolutely.
I'm Nate.
I'm David.
And we're your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelly, music by Rex Schnelly, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.